is an interview with Susie Post on December 10th at her residence in Louisville, Kentucky.
1998.
And I'm Betsy Brinson. Okay, Susie, thank you for doing this with me.
Glad to. I hope it yields you something.
Well, I think it will. I'll tell you more about this project later, how it's developing and whatnot. But today we really kind of want to focus on you and your involvement. Why don't you start at the very beginning, like where you were born, your family, siblings, parents, background.
Okay.
You're growing up.
I can do that. I'm a real anomaly. I'm a Louisville native. My father was also a Louisville native. My mother was from Terre Haute, Indiana, and they were married in 1929 and had me in 1933 in the depth of the Depression. So much of who I am is formed by the Depression experience. I had twin brother and sister who came right behind me about 2.5 years later, and the three of us grew up in this town and are all living here now. My mom and dad were very community-focused, very committed to the goals of particularly the Louisville Jewish community, which is small. It's under 10,000 people, but very sophisticated in terms of the organizations it maintains. And mom was real involved in a women's group called Hadassah, and my dad was real involved in the organizations that, the serious, important organizations that really shaped this community as a Jewish a good Jewish place to grow up. And those were the Jewish Community Federation, and he was very involved in the United Jewish Appeal, which is the annual fundraising drive in the Jewish community. So I saw a lot of activity growing up in the house, activity that was geared toward giving something back to your community. Neither my mom or dad went to school, college. Mother went to normal college up in Terre Haute, Indiana, got teaching certificate, a 2-year teaching certificate. And I think that she sort of always rested her laurels on that, although her other two sisters had the same degree. Mother was one of those women who really wanted to be more and do more, but never could break away. And part of that was because she's married to a very German patriarch. So anytime she made any effort she made to break away later, he'd just snap her back one way or another, telling her that he couldn't afford to have her work because it would drive their taxes up, income taxes up. I mean, it's just so transparent to me now. In fact, it was then, too. I had a very average, normal Jewish childhood, girlhood here. Mm-hmm. I was experienced as a school child rejection. I was not accepted into the inner sanctum of the popular kids in this 8th grade at elementary. So I decided that I had to be accepted by them. It was just desperately important to me. And that I took a survey. I thought this was pretty clever, actually. I took a survey of the class. We were all in that class for 8 years together in those days.
So we knew each public school?
Yeah, mm-hmm. County school. We knew each other pretty well, and I took a survey of the class to see what we had and maybe what role I could play. And I looked around, and there was no class clown. And so I decided to be the class clown, and the way I did it was I became the strongest girl at Melbourne Heights. I had a lot of physical strength then. I moved furniture and all the silly things that I did in order to attract attention to myself and
you're so
sort
small.
Of be accepted. Well, I guess we were all smallish then. And somehow I finally broke into the inner circle. And I think of that as how awful that must have been for a girl, you know, to have been locked out. And I don't know, I don't remember being humiliated, and I don't remember the pain and the, but I know that I felt I was locked out and I wasn't accepted and that I had to develop the strategy to become accepted. I did what all the Jewish girls growing up at that time in the 40s did. I started dating when I was 12 and 13, and I always dated boys who were much older than me. I mean, like 4 and 5 years older than me, which was ridiculous. But at the time that the Jewish community, at the time that the women and girls in the Jewish community were where I was in high school and junior high school, at the end of the Second World War, the Jewish boys who came back to Louisville from that war found that the Jewish girls who were their ages had married GIs who were sent to Fort Knox here. So there's this big vacuum. So they started reaching lower and lower, deeper and deeper into the community. So probably most of us very unhealthily went out with boys who were 3 and 4 and 5 years older than us. I had a couple proposals when I was 16. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Did you entertain any of them?
No. Oh, God, no. So I decided that what I wanted to do was go to medical school and announced that to my mother one night when we were washing dishes, or she was washing, I was drying. And she said, oh, you can't do that. She said they have a Jewish quota and a female quota. And I guess I didn't want to do it very badly because I didn't, you know, I took her at her word and that was that. So I sort of set my aspirations much lower, went away to Indiana University as a freshman. Became an English literature major, which is what all we all did in those days when we didn't know what we were going to do. Joined the NAACP, and that was in 1951 to 52.
What prompted?
And the reason I did that, when I had a marvelous teacher in my senior year at high school, she was a problems teacher.
A what kind of
problems they called it? Sort of sociology is what it was. Okay. And we had assignments, and we had to do some research and do a paper on some issue of social significance at the time, and I did maybe it was my junior year, I guess, I decided I wanted to do a study of the American Negro, which is what we called black people back then. First we called them colored, then we called them Negro, then we called them black, and then we're calling them African American. God knows what comes next. And I went down to the Louisville Urban League in Louisville and to get some data and some reports from them, and did this paper and got sort of fascinated by the situation, and I don't know what turned me on to that. I don't know why. It certainly wasn't anything that was in the air in 1951 in Louisville. I mean, it was like nobody talked about race. It just didn't exist as an issue. But...
Well, let me stop you there. Because in Louisville in the 40s, Thurgood Marshall was working with the NAACP around some issues.
Right, but I wasn't even cognizant of it.
Anyway. Well, let me take you back a little bit more. You were aware, I assume, that it was a segregated society.
I'm not sure.
You went to school.
Oh yeah, I know, but it was not, as I say, right. Race was not an issue.
Okay.
So I went to a school that was segregated sexually. I went to an all-girls high school. Mm-hmm. In those days, the only school that wasn't segregated sexually was mm-hmm. Central High, which was the only black school. Mm-hmm. So they didn't have to protect the parents. We didn't protect black girls from black boys. But I don't remember being terribly aware of it. I guess I knew it on one level, but it wasn't that palpable that it was, you know. And I can't tell you that any one incident triggered in me a real deep passion to try and set the equation right. I have no idea. Mm-hmm. I joined the student NAACP because of this paper that I'd done in high school and my realization that there was gross inequity. But it was, it wasn't something I confronted on a daily basis. It was more an intellectual exercise. Mm-hmm.
And you graduated again, what year?
51.
51, okay.
One of the friends I made immediately when I went up to Indiana was a graduate English student from New York City who was, her last name was Baumgarten, and she was the niece of Kermit Baumgarten, who was a big theater mover and shaker, very big name in New York City theater. And we liked each other a whole lot. And I invited her home with me one weekend, and she readily accepted. And in those days, Indiana University, which is 90 miles to the north of Louisville, could only be arrived by train. There was a Monon train that took 4 hours, if you can believe it, or almost 4 hours to get from Louisville to Bloomington, Indiana, and because none of the students had cars. I mean, it was just mm-hmm. a different time. So Sandy and I arranged to come home on one particular weekend. We got home on the Monon train, pulled into Union Station, which is down at 10th and Broadway, and is now the TARC bus headquarters. We get off the train. We're walking down the platform to go into the
terminal.
Station. Mm-hmm. And I turn around, and Sandy is white as a ghost. I mean, she's just stopped in her track, and she's white as a ghost. And I said, "What's the matter?" And I followed her eyes where she was looking, and what she saw was colored drinking fountain, white waiting room, colored waiting room. And I looked at that, and she was horrified. She would never come back to Louisville after that again. And what's interesting, I think, about that is that that had been a situation I'd been exposed to many, many, many times and not seen. And it took this experience with a stranger mm-hmm. for me to see it. That had a profound impact on me. I mean, that not only that I saw it, but that I hadn't seen it.
And you were already a member of the NAACP,
right.
But
I hadn't seen it because it's so pervasive. It's everywhere, and you just get used to it.
How did your family feel about you joining the NAACP?
I don't think they
that
ever knew
pretty
it.
Pretty unusual.
I don't
at that
think
time.
I've ever told them. I sort of felt that my mom and dad were beneath me intellectually, which is a terrible way to phrase it, but that's the way, you know, because I was in college and they hadn't really gone to a real college, although Dad went to Knight Law School. And they were fairly well read. They were not uneducated, but they had no formal education. Mm-hmm. And they sort of subscribed to the beliefs that were current in the local Jewish community at the time and didn't really adopt other new attitudes. So I just sort of, I wasn't close to them that way. Mm-hmm. Although, interestingly enough, in my later years, my father promoted everything I did, supported me, you know, and I was out there on some really wild issues, and he just thought I was wonderful, and he sort of agreed with me, and he had good instincts and good values. It just never got really worked out. At the time that I went away to Indiana University, which was the 50s, were so ho-hum, and so those were the times of crinoline skirts and white buck shoes or saddle shoes and bobby socks. And I remember everything I wore was one size at least too big so that my body wouldn't show through it. I wore size 38 and 40 pullover sweaters so that nobody could tell I had breasts. It was just amazing.
And intellectual shorts?
Huh?
Bermuda shorts?
That was later, 52 or 3. Mm-hmm. I wore Bermuda shorts with knee socks and a little plaid belt. I think that the absence of any real intellectual ferment or stimulation in my life at that time is a great loss. I think that I would have obviously developed differently if I'd had more of that. What I had, I craved, and I married a man who I was attracted to basically on the strength of his intellect. He was a very smart man. And it wasn't a great emotional marriage. It was, I thought, a meeting of two minds, and I thought he was, at that point, I really believed somehow, came to the conclusion that we needed a revolution in this country. I mean, this is beyond race, that the inequities that existed had to be changed, and I thought he felt the same way because he knew all the Spanish Civil War songs and all the good old labor songs. So we got married in 53.
How did you meet?
I knew him from the time I was 13. He just hung out he was 4 years older. I met him the first time at a dance. I was a friend of his sister's, mm-hmm. and he cut in on somebody I was dancing with.
And he was from here in Louisville,
He was
too.
From New York, but moved here when his family moved here when he was 12. He was a real mm-hmm. prick. Mm-hmm. I mean, in those years, I'll tell you, the first date I had with him, we walked to the movies. I was 13 or 14. He was 17 or 18. We're walking to the movies in the neighborhood, and he said something about Das Kapital. And I said, "What?" And he said, "Well, haven't you read Das Kapital?" Huh? He was a real intellectual snob, and he was humbled later on in life, but he was just a terrible prick. And I think what happened with him and me was that I had this real sexual awakening, or wanted to have this real sexual activity when I was 18 and 19, and we just didn't do that. There were no pills, and I was terrified of pregnancy. And he was available. One night we went to see a movie. I hadn't seen him for a couple of years. One night we went to see a movie. It was very romantic, and I just got all juiced up. So honestly, it was just the silliest reason to get married, because I either married him because of intellect, which it turned out wasn't really where I thought it was going to be, or because of sex, which is a really stupid reason to get married. And then had five kids and stayed together for 33 years.
So you dropped out of Indiana to get
married? I moved.
Married,
I came home. I transferred to the University of Louisville. We were married in my end of my sophomore year. He went into the Navy. It was at the end of the Korean War. People were being drafted. He hadn't gone to OCS. He'd gone to law school. After law school, he signed up for 4 years with the Officers' Kim's School so he wouldn't be drafted. We went from Louisville. He got orders to San Francisco. I mean, really, that was. And I transferred out to the University of California at Berkeley and graduated and started graduate work out there.
Okay, stop there. When you got to California, you had how many children?
None.
No children.
I was just newly married.
You were newly married, and you were there for how long?
Almost 4 years.
Okay, and you actually graduated
from Berkeley. And I had hoped that when I transferred out there that I would meet people through the university, and I didn't. It was a very Greek school in the 50s, which people meet me and they find out I came out of Berkeley and they say, oh, well, no wonder. Berkeley had very little to do with my intellectual development. It really didn't. In those days, it was really crinolines and white bucks. And Alpha Epsilon. I mean, it was so Greek, and I was so opposed. I had some very strange opinions, and I'm not sure where I got them. I thought the sororities and fraternities were horribly elitist and unreal. I didn't want to have anything to do with it. I wanted to be, if the hippies had been around then, I would have been one. They weren't. I wanted to be bohemian, but I came out of too conventional background to be able to pull that off. But I never really fit into straight, conventional social, you know, I always was very questioning, and I was always very, sort of subversive and irreverent. And I was then, too, and I got out there thinking I was going to make friends, and I didn't, because the community was just generally very transient, and the undergraduate community was very Greek, and it was too big. There were 5,000 in my graduating class, which in those days, in 1955, when I got my degree, was 5,000 was a huge number of people to graduate from the university.
You were still majoring in English?
English literature, and I graduated with honors, and graduated in 3.5 years, which I was very pleased with all the transferring, and had to pick up extra credits and blah, blah, blah. And I didn't go to my graduation. I wasn't going to go sit there through, you know, 5,000 students full of bullshit from some people, some officials I didn't know, so I didn't go. And about a month later, I went over to the Sproul Hall, which was the administration building in front of which all these free speech things were held in the 60s. This was before it hit its glory with Mario Savio. And I went in to get my diploma. So I go up to the whatever window and I said, I need my diploma. My name is Suzanne Post and I graduated, last month. So she goes and she gets a piece of paper and she gives it to me. And I turned around to walk away, and she said, excuse me, there are honors attached. So I went back, and she gave me another piece of paper. And it was that kind of a thing. And that kind of attitude is pretty much an attitude that has stayed with me. I really don't like hollow ceremonies. I had a real hard time psyching myself up to want to go to any of my children's graduations. I mean, it's not an admirable characteristic when it affects people who don't share my point of view, but I have a real hard time with hollowness. Mm-hmm. I mean, I really do. I don't know why I do, but I do.
Do you remember when you were at Berkeley, was it a predominantly white student body? You introduced
back
to
then,
other cultures? And
back then, there was already a significant Asian. In fact, the thing that I loved about the Bay Area was the diversity of its populations. And I'll tell you an interesting story that I always use. I lived about 8 blocks from campus, on a little street called McGee. And I used to shop in a little grocery store about 5 blocks away that I could walk to that wasn't a mom and pop, teeny, teeny, but it wasn't big. It was a small grocery store. And I'd go in there pretty regularly unless I had access to a car, and then I'd go over to Treasure Island where Ed was stationed and shop in the commissary because it was cheaper. And I walked, and after I'd been there 5 or 6 months, I'm in this little grocery one day, and I'm bending over the produce counter to reach for a head of lettuce, and I banked against the wall of this produce counter was a mirror running the whole length, which is frequently used to make the thing look roomier and airier and bigger. And so I'm bending in, picking up this head of lettuce, and I looked up in the mirror, and I noticed in the reflection in the mirror that I was the only white person in this little store. And I thought, gosh, that's strange. And I checked out and walked home, and on the way home I'm thinking, you know, this neighborhood that I live in is like 40% white, maybe 40, 45% white, maybe 20, 25% Asian, maybe 10% black, maybe another X percent Native American. And it had been like that from the day I moved in, obviously, and I never noticed it until it was like the colored waiting room and the black waiting room all over, white waiting room all over again. I had never noticed that even though I came from a very, very traditional white Jewish background in Louisville. And I tell people the reason I didn't notice it is because that community worked so well. It was just, that's just our community. That's all it is. And I think that was that and the physical beauty of the Bay Area were the two things that really hooked me. And when 4 years later I moved back to Louisville, I was very depressed. For about 6 months, went through a real...
You came back?
Came back in 1957.
Okay.
And I came back pregnant with a second child. Ed was going to, we were going to start a new life. We had all kinds of possibilities, and I was really down. And I didn't even quite understand why I was down. It was only later that I could look back on that period and realize that I was grieving for this community that I'd left, because I had returned to a community that was, you had two choices. You could be black or white, you could be Baptist, or you could be Catholic. That's it. I believe it was much different than it was in 57. So that was really hard for me after the Bay Area experience, because I thought the diversity was just wonderful. It was so interesting, and I really loved it. When I came back in 57, one of the very first things I did was join the American Civil Liberties Union, which had just been formed in 1955 around the Braden Sedition Trial. My father had started sending me clippings from the newspaper about that trial and about Ann and Carl. I just thought it was just the most outrageous thing I ever heard of. And I also sort of knew that the right to political dissent was really going to be in jeopardy in this state unless there was a strong voice in support of, you know, free speech. And I think the ACLU, when I joined it, maybe had 120 members or something. And I sort of valued the concept without being terribly familiar with the organization and wanted to support it. And not too many years later, I think I had maybe three children, so it might have been two years later, the woman who was their executive secretary, she was a wife of a psychology professor at the university who just died, was being paid to keep records of the FKCLU and to get out the newsletter and do simple clerical stuff like that. And she sent out a newsletter, and I guess it said, you want to volunteer, and you could check your name, and I sent it back. And she called me one day, and she asked me if I'd help her with a newsletter, and I said, yeah. And the next thing I know, she dropped my name in to be membership chair. So I got really active, and in between pregnancies, really, and that stuff, spent a lot of time with them. It wasn't the kind of organization that we really needed later. It was just sort of a white liberal old men basically talking session.
And this was still late 50s
and into the 60s. And into the 60s, it just, they talked and they would pass. It was just used to drive me crazy, Betsy. They would some horrendous situation would operate in the Commonwealth, and they'd have a board meeting, pass a resolution condemning it, and never do a damn thing with the resolution. They wouldn't send it to the paper. They wouldn't send it to the body that had Well, it's just absurd, and it drove me crazy. I mean, I didn't want to waste my time and energy working with an organization that wasn't going to develop some kind of an active program. So I got more and more deeply involved in the 60s, of course. In terms of my personal life, I guess a couple of general observations. You've asked me to try and remember women who were active in the civil, white women who were active in the civil rights movement, and I've been thinking about that a lot. And there really weren't very many of us, and including me. I wasn't, and I've always thought that I wasn't real active because I was having five children every other year. Not five every other year, one every other year until I got to five. But in thinking about it, I was reminded myself of the fact that back in those days, if you wanted to be effective, you worked through a man. Mm-hmm. And I can remember really clearly two occasions on which I did that. One was when Barry Goldwater was running against Lyndon Johnson in 64. And I was just horrified by Goldwater's conservatism. And I just couldn't bear it, and I wanted somebody, our Democratic governor, who was Ned Bretha, to do something, and he just sat on his butt, and he didn't do a thing, and it kept driving me nuts, because I felt, at the time, as did a lot of people, that Goldwater was going to, run to victory, and then we were going to have who knows what, be bombed back to the Stone Age. So what I did was so, I think, typical of American women with a activist bent in this part of the country. I programmed Ed. I kept working on Ed and working on Ed and working on Ed until finally he got as concerned as I did. And this was pretty true of my whole marriage to him. I'd be upset about an issue and I'd work on him until finally he got to where I was, because I had to pull him along just kicking and screaming. All he really wanted to do was practice law. And I worked on him enough so that he set out to create a Citizens for Johnson committee. And he got nine other men who would put up $1,000 and commit to working on this campaign and find 10 other men, or it wasn't 1,000 because we didn't have 1,000, it must have been 100. But they committed to raise $10,000 to open an office. And the office was opened, and these men, and they were all men. I mean, the idea of something like that happening today is too hilarious for words. But there were 10 white men who were the Citizens for Johnson campaign. And the governor eventually had to deal with them, because we were doing something, except the people who were running it were women. Mm-hmm. It was all women running it.
We did everything.
They had these intellectual talking sessions, but we'd program them stuff. And mm-hmm. This is absurd. I mean, it's such a waste of energy. Mm-hmm. I mean, think about how difficult it was for us mm-hmm. to make our voices heard. The same thing happened with the McCarthy campaign. I was one of the two state coordinators for the Gene McCarthy campaign 4 years later. And by then I had gotten some political savvy and was really a pretty good organizer. And I was spending a lot of time organizing my legislative district, which was highly charged politically, very progressive district. And I had Ed front for me on the day of the congressional convention. He was the one who got up there in front of people. And later I started to get really angry about, why didn't, and he didn't do any of the shit work or any of the hard work. Mm-hmm. And he gets out there in front, and I'm thinking, at least he did it, at least. Mm-hmm. But that was so typical, and in terms of the civil rights movement, women just didn't have, and it wasn't just white women, black women didn't have that role right. either. It was all right. of us were in the back of the bus.
Yeah, I'm finding that more.
Yeah,
and more.
So that was really a product of women's failure to take control of their lives. And I think what changed for me was really the radical women who came south to work on the anti-war movement. A lot of SDS, University of Chicago, Vassar women who came south to work on the movement and who were pissed because the way they were treated in the anti-war movement. Some of them had been in the civil rights movement in the South, and they didn't like that either. And they started talking to me, and they really radicalized me as far as women's, I hate to use the word oppression because it's a little too big a word, but whatever it was, that exploitation, I certainly think we were exploited. They began to work on me, and I began to listen to them, and I began to see parallels in terms of my marriage and, you know, the larger social issues, and it was a really exhilarating experience. They were very sharp, and I've always felt that I've owed younger women a real debt because they took the time with me.
Okay, let me stop you there a minute. By 1961, Louisville, as I understand it, actually had experienced a series of protests from the black community and boycotts against particular merchants
stores,
and whatnot.
Right.
Do you remember
any
of that?
No memory of it.
Okay. Or do you recall any sort of violent incidents that got reported in the media? Or
I remember nothing of it.
Okay.
Sort of sad.
Okay. Well, and I'm not even sure how much of it was reported in the media.
The first time I recall any effort of white people, and it was pretty much spearheaded by white women, to make some inroads on the race issue was the open housing movement.
I want to get to that
in
a minute.
You're not there yet.
No. Did you continue to belong to the NAACP, or did you give that up when you went to Berkeley?
Well, I didn't. No, it was a student chapter.
Right.
And even today, you never get a bill from the NAACP for your membership. I mean, you have to call them up and say, would you please? It's so absurd. I didn't join again until probably the 60s.
Okay. Do you recall what prompted you to do that?
Probably all the stuff that was going on
all
over in the 60s.
Okay. Do you recall growing up or till that period, reading any black literature or seeing plays or?
None, totally bereft, it's completely sterile.
Okay. Of the women who came from the North, were there any in particular that you remember, that you can recall from?
Joan Goldsmith is her name. She lives in California now. She came out of Antioch, in fact, later married the son of a president of Antioch after they'd lived together 5 years, and then, of course, they did what everybody did. They split up. She wrote a Vietnam curriculum guide. I think she was living in Boston at that time, and her younger brother worked with me in the anti-war stuff. And she was just amazing. I haven't seen her for a long time, but we talk. And Joni is about 15 years younger than I am, I guess. She's probably about 50 now. She was one of the most... she was one who had a lot of impact on me. Another one is a woman named Joy Portugal, who is Canadian, who is a member of the Communist Party, and who came to Louisville to work with Ann and Carl at SCAF. I mean, she came from McGill and wanted actively, as did a lot of young people in those days, work with Ann and Carl because they had this biracial campaign in the South. And she had a lot of impact on me. She was also about 15 years younger than me, and I still stay very in touch, much in touch with Joy. She's worked for a variety of unions, and she went to New York about 10 or 12 years ago to take a job as editor of the Daily World for $8,000. And managed. I do not know how anybody lives in New York City on $80,000, but then later my son did it too, so I guess it can be done if you're committed. So she had an impact on me.
Has she come back to Louisville?
She comes back to visit, and she owns a duplex here. And she's still very politically tied in.
Okay. I've been told about another woman who worked with Anne, who...
Jan Phillips?
Laurie? Who's actually now doing theater or art or something of that sort.
There's so many. Was it Eileen, I wonder?
I don't know. I could go back.
There's a whole range of women. The women who were here with the greatest permanence, length of time, were Joy and a woman named J.M. Phillips, who worked for Ann, who you probably want to talk to, who is just leaving a job as the director of the Louisville Tennis Association. She's a very close friend of mine. She was the Communist Party organizer for Kentucky for a number of years. And she's leaving the Tennis Association to run a party scholarship fund called the Davis Fund, which is sort of located, you know, major locus is New York. And she's going to do development and outreach for that out here in Louisville. So you should talk to her. Her telephone number is 451-1820, is home. And work is 587-0290. She doesn't have an answering machine at home.
Okay.
But she'd be really good material. She's not from Louisville.
Okay.
The women who came and worked with Ann and Carl were not from Louisville. Okay. They were transplants. Okay.
1968, do you recall any of the riots in Louisville?
Oh, God, yes.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, there were, I think the one I remember best was the one at 28th and Greenwood, which was really a mess. But it was, you know, you had a little mini riots, but for Louisville, they were very significant. And I think, that was fomented by a guy named James Cortez, who was a real crazy black guy who was sort of flitted. And I'm not even sure that there were any major issues or what they were. Ann would know that far better than I, because I was, my job during that time was just to help raise money to get people out of jail.
Mm-hmm.
I know there was an effort at about that time by our Commonwealth's attorney to prosecute some black leadership for supposedly plotting to blow up the West, you know about that one. And it's just ridiculous baby stuff. And the police chief was a guy named William Hyde, who had a little black book of Louisville's most dangerous people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pathetic. I mean, it was just pathetic. Somebody got their hands on it, was printed, and Carl was in there. And
so your job, you said, was to
my
raise
job,
money?
My job, that's all I did.
Bail?
I raised money for bail.
How'd you do that?
Well, we had a certain list that we just worked, and we called people and said, you know, and they kicked in, because people were very upset about what was happening, and there was a lot of railroading going on, and a lot of innocent people being shoved, you know, into jail, and mm-hmm. it's, I guess our first exposure to that was the open housing campaign, because there was some spillover on the streets in that, and an awful lot of people went to jail, and I remember one time the ACLU had its new members party at the home of a black physician named Maurice Rabb. He had a big basement room, and somebody gone down to get people out of jail so they could come to this party. It was just a really heady, I didn't know most of the people had been arrested. I mean, it was a very heady experience, because you felt like, you know, we were all sort of working at this together. But I did very, very little, very, very little, because I was really, I had these five children, and there was no way I could, that I had the energy to do both. Moreover, at that time, I had a really unsupportive husband who, it was just too much. So I did very, very little. I mean, my heart was there. And in fact, that whole civil rights effort coupled with the anti-war campaign sort of merged to become, I think, the precipitating factor in the breakup of my marriage, which didn't occur until 1986.
Mm-hmm.
It took that long. But
how do you see that?
Well, I was at the time so convinced of the immorality of what was occurring, both racially and I guess I thought the Vietnam War was a racial thing too. And our involvement in that country, where I didn't feel we had any business, I'm just so convinced of that. And it seemed to be, you know, that was the civil rights issues and the anti-war issues were the defining issues of my world. And I was married to a man who told me that he had to believe that his government knew what it was doing. And then when it came to race, he'd say, yeah, it's terrible, and didn't do anything, you know? I mean, just didn't do anything. And then I'm hanging out with all these much younger radicals, and I just thought they were so right.
Mm-hmm.
And
Were your children old enough, any of them at that point, to have any feelings or reactions to what you were involved in? Or what you
believed? I'm sure they were. I'm not sure that we've ever really fully explored it. I went to all the demonstrations, and usually the children, or a portion of the children who were able, went with me. My son David went to the first Vietnam moratorium that left here in 68, or was it 69? It must have been 68 because he was 13. Two buses left from the seminary to go up to Washington, and I went over to take some cookies to my friends who were riding the buses, and they had an extra seat, and he went with them. So they had to have been certainly aware of it without maybe fully understanding what the issues were. I'm sure they didn't. I'm sure that they, as the rest of the Louisville community who knew Ed and me, believed that Ed was really supportive of me. And he really wasn't. He kept trying to hold me back. And I guess I've felt that you probably can't expect a mate to agree with what you do, everything you do. But I do think you have a right to expect a mate not to oppose you on things that you consider. So I just, you know, I just sort of left that marriage pretty much emotionally, just left. It was just...
How about your parents and your brothers? Well, how did they feel about your involvement?
I didn't ask them, and my father was on my side. My mother sure didn't. She did what... I mean, she didn't allow herself to think alone. My father believed the war was obscene, and the race issue was just horrible. I mean, he was, by that time, supporting a lot of things financially that tried to... My father gave me, up until the time he died, an annual subscription to The Nation magazine, to the Daily New York Times, to... Oh, another one. Not the New Reader, but another one. And when my father died, I said, boy, I've lost my father and a subscription to three, you know, periodicals. This is terrible. He was very supportive. I think as he got older, he got more in tune, made some connections, and he got to be very outspoken. And so did my brother. My sister's, the twins were a sister and a brother, and the sister was just never involved. So I don't know. You know, there are times when I get really regret that I didn't have a partner who could have supported me. But, you know, that happens. I'm sure that's the history of women.
So in 1968, you ran for the state legislature?
75.
Oh, 75. That was later.
It was later.
Okay. Well, two things.
When David Karam, you know who David Karam is? He's a state senator, the House Majority Speaker, or whatever they call him. Speaker of the House. No, whatever. I don't know what his title is, but he's the big muckety muck in Frankfurt. David Karam.
Okay, and what about
Louisville.
Him? And what
he decided in 75 to not run for the for the House and to run for the Senate. When he decided to leave that, I decided to run for his seat because I have really had it up to my kazoo in helping people get elected to office, and then you go to them with your issue, and they say, "Oh yeah, I agree with you, Susie, but."
And what were your campaign issues?
My campaign issues were probably what got me defeated. Pro-choice, anti-death penalty, pro-civil rights. And I had a huge number of people working for me. I mean, I had all the Gene McCarthy people left over from 68. I got elected to the State Central Committee of the Democratic Party in that campaign. So I had all the people who worked in the McCarthy campaign. I had all the women who, you know, believed that choice was crucial, and I had the white civil rights people in that district. It was a fabulous group. I mean, I had more damn fun. I really did have fun, and it was a very close race. It really was. And the woman who beat me was a good person. She had been on the Board of Aldermen two terms and decided to run when she got in some political trouble down there, even though I had told her I'd help her raise money if she'd ran for mayor. So, and I would have gone crazy up there, Betsy. I mean, I like the big, you know, I don't want to deal with land use stuff and regulations. And
So after that campaign, did you think about running again?
Never.
No.
Okay. Never.
Okay.
Never.
So what was happening, two things really. I'm going to go way back to early 60s. Governor Burke Combs and then Ned Breathitt that you talked about. And Combs actually was responsible, at least some things happened under his term, like the establishment of the Commission on Human Relations.
Mm-hmm.
And then Breathitt takes credit for some civil rights activity at some point.
Yeah.
But do you have any recollection or perspective?
No, I don't think they did anything other than what they were forced to do. I don't think either of those men had any vision whatsoever. Bert was a really smart guy. He was a much better federal judge than he was governor of Kentucky. Well, he was an honest governor.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think those were issues mm-hmm. that they were forced, I mean, they were foisted upon them.
Mm-hmm.
The Kentucky Commission on Human Rights, like most of those agencies, was created to work some, to take off a lot of heat and work minimum change, you know, and mm-hmm. the present director, who you and I both know, is a close friend of mine, and I just agonize with her over some of the stuff that, you know, they have to deal with. It's just, mm-hmm. you know, but that's the way, that's what they're created to be.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't created to do anything really major.
Didn't you serve on a... Yes,
on the local
did.
One.
Right, from 75 to 82 as the women's
as a staff director, person.
A staff
and then
person.
From 82 to about 90-something, I was a commissioner there.
Okay.
It was very demoralizing. I'm lobbying right now to try, in this as a member of this transition team, to get that agency's charter changed because it's dysfunctional as hell. And they have 21 members, so they can never get a quorum. I mean, this goes back forever.
Mm-hmm.
And the mayor and the county judge stick people on there who haven't a clue what civil rights.
Go back to the McCarthy campaign. I wonder if you recall any African Americans working in that campaign.
Not one.
Okay. Okay. Louisville, I believe. Of course, the Brown decision in 54, but Louisville didn't actually begin to desegregate schools until 56.
And then it was flawed because Omar Carmichael, the Louisville school superintendent, said that anybody could go to any school that they wanted to go to. What he didn't say was, as long as there's a space. And so black kids who might want to go to a white school had no chance of getting in there unless... You know, so you might have a smattering one here and two there, but it was just let's take the restrictions down, seeing what happens, and given the housing patterns, and mm-hmm. I mean, it just nothing much occurred. And he got this big deal from President Eisenhower at that time because we were supposed to have done such a great job of peaceful desegregation, and nothing really changed.
Mm. And then. I think in 72, you were a plaintiff in a lawsuit.
Right.
School desegregation
right.
again. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, in 1969, I became the president of what was then KCLU. And in
Kentucky Civil Liberties Union, 1970,
we were approached by some black people. Who, and most notably, I guess, Lyman Johnson, who had desegregated the University of Kentucky graduate school. We were approached by Lyman and some other people about suing the Board of Education of Louisville. So we studied it and we debated it and we had endless meetings as to whether or not we wanted to undertake that. It was a big, ambitious proposal, and we even had hearings in the black community to find out what black people wanted, and it went on and on. And finally, in 1972, Bob Settler, who was our general counsel, volunteer general counsel, and a tenured law professor at U of K, filed suit. And in the course of putting that suit together, he thought he would like to have a white plaintiff who had children, white children in the public schools. So I said, sure.
And so, how old were your children at that time?
Oh, in 1972, David was born in 55. He's my oldest one. And the youngest one was 10 years younger. So
he would have been in high school.
Yeah. So they were all in public schools. So, it gave me some legitimacy to go out there and try and promote mm-hmm. peaceful school desegregation. And I got real immersed in it. I mean, the thing dragged on from 72 till 75 when it was really finally implemented. And there was enormous opposition in the county, just enormous opposition. I mean, it was an organizing vehicle for the Klan and for every little Save Our Community School group that you could, and the county was just ringed with opponents and organizing against school desegregation because it meant busing their kids. And it was very tempestuous. It's the most tempestuous period I've lived through in this town.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about this a little bit in greater detail here, if we can. You filed in federal court.
Right.
Do you remember who the judge was or
what you were? Yeah, that was Gordon.
Talk about him.
Well, he was Republican. He was very conservative. The most interesting thing about he got overruled twice by the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, and finally on the third time, he just said desegregate. I mean, he said you got to have a plan in 6 weeks, and that's it. Mm-hmm. And so the Board of Education of Louisville had a demographer who whipped out this plan literally in 6 weeks that the city was stuck with, and it's a pretty good plan, amazingly. Judge Gordon went through a major transformation, having been overturned twice on this thing, and he began to come around, and he and Bob Settler began to develop a very collegial relationship. And Tom Hogan, who took over the case when Bob Settler left Louisville, and he had a very close relationship. Mm-hmm. Tom was...
Who is Tom?
Tom Hogan was a young attorney who was a very dear, dear friend of mine, who had worked in Frankfurt in the General Assembly as an aide, who's a feisty little Irishman who was just, I just adored him. He was about 15 years younger than me, too. And he signed up, he was a ACLU member, he'd been a president, but he was hired by Galen Martin of the Kentucky Commission on Human Rights to take a suit that was broader than the ACLU suit originally. The ACLU suit was a lawsuit challenging the Louisville Board of Education. Galen wanted a merger suit. We didn't file a merger suit after these hearings in the black community because the black community didn't want it for the same reasons they don't want merger of city-county government today. They're afraid they'd lose their power base. At the time that the original suit was filed, there were 5 Louisville school board members, 3 of whom were black. They knew that if they merged with the county, they're going to lose that.
And this would just be a merger of the school system,
right,
not all
right,
of them.
Right, right. So Galen got Tom Hogan, who had once worked for the Kentucky Commission on Human Rights, to file a suit that was a separate suit merging. The judge eventually ordered that the two suits, the ACLU suit and the Kentucky Commission suit, be merged. Tom Hogan, who was younger and less experienced than Bob Settler, worked alongside Bob. They worked beautifully together. Bob eventually left and went to Cornell. When he left, he turned everything over to Hogan to carry out the terms of the lawsuit. Where was I going with this?
Who was the other plaintiff?
Oh, there are a lot of them. Okay. There was a guy named Earl Aloisi, who was a vice president at the University of Louisville. There was a woman named Penny Lane, who had been a CETA worker in our office. God, who else was there? I can't even remember. There were about 6 or 7 of them.
Okay.
I mean, they just try to cover all their bases in terms of having standing.
Right. Was there a lot of news publicity about filing the suit?
Oh, it was front page headlines, yes.
And
from that time on, from the day that lawsuit was filed until just about till I left the ACLU in 1982, so from 1970 when we started talking about it to 1972 when it was filed to 1982 when I left the ACLU to take this other job, was I able to divorce myself from that lawsuit. I felt very responsible for all the negative things that were happening as a consequence of that. I worked in one coalition after another to try and force some changes in procedures at the Board of Education that resulted in the disproportionate suspensions of black kids, and the tracking of them, channeling of them into EMH classes and BD classes, and it was just...
BD, what's BD?
Behavioral disorder.
Okay.
This behavioral... I think that's what it is, behavioral disability. I may have lost an acronym in there. But for all those years, I really felt so personally responsible that I couldn't back off. It was just so, and now I'm just like, it's not anywhere on my, I just can't deal with that, burnt out. So I spent, at the same time I was monitoring compliance with the court order as a member of the Human Relations Commission staff, I was doing Title IX monitoring at the Human Relations Commission of the Board of Education. So I was at the Board of Education every damn meeting they had. I spent wedding anniversaries, birthdays out there constantly. They were horrible meetings. They were horrible meetings. There's so much bureaucracy. I mean, I just, and I was trying to organize, and it was just like this massive expenditure of energy to try and remedy, you know, what the lawsuit had not changed. And to this day, those problems prevail. The problem of, you know, too many suspensions of black kids, disproportionate suspension, not enough kids and no black kids in advanced programs, too many black kids in educably mentally handicapped classes when teachers just can't figure out how to relate to these. I mean, it's just not enough black administrators, not enough black teachers, although that figure's come up a little bit. But it was really probably one of the most expensive things I've ever done in my life.
I want to talk a little bit about that. And this was before you were involved with the ACLU, but you had not yet become the director of the ACLU.
No, I was president of the board.
The board, okay.
And there were very few, I should tell you. I don't. At the time that I became president in 69, I think there was maybe one other president, woman president of an ACLU affiliate. And then in 70, I got myself elected to the national board, which is when you met me. And that was my mission. That was my agenda when I went up there and got my, I purposely got myself elected. I mean, I lobbied hard.
What was your agenda?
Women's issues, trying to get more women into it in leadership positions and trying to get the organization to be responsive to women's program needs. So,
go back to the lawsuit. How did the community relate to you as an individual in doing that?
Badly. Well, depends which community you're talking about. The Jewish community couldn't stand me. I'll give you a newspaper article. Have you looked in the Courier Journal first? I had some stuff, what do they call it when you take stuff to Kinko's and they put that plastic over it?
Laminated.
Thank you. I can never remember that word. I was going through some stuff the other day and I had some things laminated for the children, had copies made for the children of newspaper articles and stuff that appeared. And I'll give you, don't let me not give you one which you can give me back.
Okay.
Because I only had five copies made. That the Courier Journal did about a year ago last July, which tells this story. My daughter was coming when she was eight, was walking home from school. When she was eight, that would have been 73.
So the case
was
about a year?
No, it would have been 73. It was 65, 72. She must have been older because she was walking home alone with this kid from school. She must have been 10 or 11. And they came, and the school was in an easy walking distance of my house, and they came to the end of the street. We lived on a little dead-end street. And Rachel turned off to go down that street, and this little girl who was walking with her said, "Oh, that's where that awful Susie Post lived." And Rachel said, "That's my mom." And my son Stephen tells the story, and you'll see it in this newspaper clipping I'm going to give you. He wrote a column about me. He writes for a Madison newspaper from time to time. And he wrote a column about me for Mother's Day, didn't tell me about it. And he told the story of how when he was in junior high school, or high school, he and another friend went to a women's club to give some kind of a presentation. I probably haven't gotten any of these facts right. Anyway, after they gave a presentation, one of the women said to the other student who was with him, whose last name was also Post, she was the daughter of a doctor who lived a couple blocks away, the woman said to Martha, "Oh, are you that terrible, that awful Susie Post daughter?" And Stephen said, "No, that's me. That's my mother. Is that awful Susie Post your mother?" And Stephen says, "No, she's my mother." And so I've often said to other friends of mine that, you know, it doesn't make me feel good to know that I did what I did without really considering what the consequences might be to my children. Because I was so convinced of the moral rightness of what I was doing and had such an urgent need to do it. And I could rationalize now and say, well, I was trying to make the world a better place for them too. But no, I was just trying to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And I never even thought about what that might do mm-hmm. in terms of my children.
Did they come home and tell you these stories? Were they?
No, they didn't. Yeah. They really didn't. And I said something to Stephen, who's now a college professor, not too long ago. I said, you know, wasn't it awful? I mean, I was out there all the time. I was in the newspaper all the time. He said, no, I said, I thought it was pretty cool. The other kids' mothers make cookies. He said, and I thought it was pretty cool. I don't know if mm-hmm. he really thought it was cool what was going on. Maybe he did. Mm-hmm. But.
And how about Ed?
Ed was really afraid that it was going to reflect badly on him and his law practice. And in fairness to Ed, it could be that his not wanting to get out there was concerned that he might not be able to provide for his family. It might have deleterious mm-hmm. effect on his income producing. I don't know. We never talked about it. I didn't ask him either. I mean, I'd gotten to the point where I didn't ask. Mm-hmm. I just did. When I went up to, I guess one of the most painful memories I have is when I went to New York the first time in 1969 for a development conference up in Lake Mohonk.
The ACLU?
Yeah, it was the first time. In 1969, I was 36 years old. 36 years old. He didn't want me to go. He did not want me to go. He said, you're not going to go. And you know what I did? I cried. I mean, can you believe? I mean, I looked back and I cried. Why didn't I say, screw you, I'm going to go? I didn't. I cried and cried. I went. I mean, I was determined to go. I went. I got elected. I was the first woman on what they used to call the steering committee. It was a really boring group of three EDs, three elected at large, and no, there were nine of us. I can't remember who the other three were.
So this is the steering committee of
that allocated money that used to make grants before the sharing.
No, you wouldn't.
It's the dark ages. But I mean, they'd sit around. They'd take grants from applications from affiliates and decide which affiliate was going to get some money. Hmm. And it was a pretty powerful position. They never had a woman. And I'm like one woman and eight men. And I'll tell you who helped me get elected. In fact, asked me to run was Jay Miller from mm-hmm. Illinois. Mm-hmm. So the day I got elected, that night, well, the day I got elected, I called home to tell Edward. And I said, guess what? And I knew he wasn't happy about my being up here all by myself. I think it was sexual jealousy, really. I said, I got elected to the steering committee. And there's this little deep silence. And he says, does that mean you got to go away again? I said, well, three times a year. And his silence was deafening. And I was so hurt. I mean, you know, I was so excited. I was really proud of myself. Mm-hmm. So, like I said, my marriage started to unfold, mm-hmm. dissolve in 68, and this didn't help mm-hmm. that he was just... But... We never discussed anything. I just did what I wanted to do, and whether or not that's a great way to run a marriage or a family, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But
did you meet anybody out of the whole school deseg litigation that you became good friends with, who supported you?
No, I can't remember that I did. Ann and I had had a relationship prior to that time, and Braden. A woman named, no, I didn't even meet her at that time, the current school board member. But she didn't really, no, I don't think so. I just didn't have much support. Bob Sadler, the lawyer, mm-hmm. was very supportive, and Tom Hogan, the other lawyer, was very supportive. Mm-hmm. But no, I would go into things in the Jewish community and it was like smallpox had been introduced into the room. One time I had Dr. Spock down here in 70, I think this is prior to school deseg. And I brought him here to talk about anti-war stuff. And we had this huge meeting
And there were 700 people there at that time because he was real involved in draft counseling. And we were doing a lot of it. And when he got up to speak, he mentioned Fred Hampton and the Black Panther murders in Chicago. Wow, I go to a party somewhere like a week later, and this woman, who's the wife of my pediatrician, says, "What about the Black Panthers?" I mean, real hostile. So I was.
She was associating them with you,
right,
as a result of having brought Dr. Spock here.
So I was too far ahead of the community, really.
Mm-hmm.
Ironically, that community just voted, just gave me this last May its most prestigious award, which is very funny. But, you know, things change.
The
Jewish community. I mean, it's just sort of... So I think I was ahead of my time as far as the Jewish community was concerned.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're where they should be, but not quite. So, no, I don't think I had... It was pretty lonely, I got to say. It was... I mean, you know, I had a relationship with the KCLU board,
right,
but they weren't really intimate friends.
Right. And where was the NAACP with the
litigation? It had a cooperating attorney who was there titularly, if there's such a word, but who didn't do anything. He's now a county commissioner. His name's Daryl Owens, and
did
he's a good friend.
File?
They were part of it. They were attorneys of record, too, but they didn't do anything. They were just there for window dressing.
Okay. Did you ever have any interaction with Georgia Power?
Not really, although Tom
Georgia
Hogan
Davis
had
Power,
worked with her a lot,
right,
in the legislature, but she was not involved in that Scooty sex suit.
How about a woman named Lukey Ward?
No, she wasn't either. My first involvement with Lukey was when I ran for the General Assembly in 75. She sort of insinuated herself into my good offices, and I use this language quite deliberately, because she had an axe to grind with my opponent, and she wanted to get the other woman, and the way she was going to get her was to have me beat her. I mean, it took me a long time to realize that, but no, I didn't. I'm one of the people who wasn't, when she was marching much earlier, and she was about the only white woman around, I was somewhere else. And I'm sure that what she did was admirable. I've never had any really great experiences with her, but I'm sure that she did some really good things, because people say so.
It sounds like she knew the Democratic Party structure and worked in campaigns much earlier.
Yeah. She was
worked
from
in
the
George's
East.
Campaign.
Yeah, they were very good friends.
And she's dead now, right?
Yes, she died about 3 years ago. Not quite.
Okay.
Her son was elected to Congress, and then when she died, he blew the next election, and we've got a conservative Republican over here named Van Northup.
How about Eleanor Love, Whitney Young's sister?
I never knew her. Oh, I do, Dr. Love.
Right, she's still living.
Yeah, she was the commission president when I was on the commission. I never really saw her in an activist position, and in fact, Eleanor Love was president of the commission when... the nomination of, oh God, I'm having brain trouble today. The black Supreme Court justice.
Thurgood Marshall?
No,
Clarence Thomas.
When Clarence Thomas was nominated, the commission was going to pass a resolution endorsing his nomination, and I spoke passionately against it. But Eleanor Love was the chair of the commission, and she supported it, and they came within a hair's breadth of doing that.
And what happened to... that they didn't?
Well, I stopped them, basically. I was so vociferous, and none of them had enough of a feel for him.
Okay, and at that point, you were a commission member?
I was a commissioner, right.
Okay. Good for you.
Yeah, well, good for me.
Right, well, I'm actually listening to Anita Hill's book about the whole experience on tape now as I'm driving around the state.
It just killed me to have to go to work in those days, that I couldn't hear those things.
Right.
Just killed me.
Right. I want to talk a little bit. How are we doing?
Yeah, give me a little time to take a shower and get dressed.
I want to talk about the whole housing movement, because my recollection is that was early on a big piece of the program, the civil rights program in this community. was an issue.
Oh, yeah, it was. The open housing movement, I'm not exactly sure, and Anne is much better resource on this than me. As you know, I don't keep notes. I didn't keep a journal. I'm so sorry now. I keep dumping on myself for having not done those things. I mean, I do it with great regularity. Oh, why didn't you keep a record of that? That was a really interesting time. My involvement in the open housing movement was to, you know, support it, to help.
And goes back to when?
I'm not even sure, Betsy, what year that was. I really don't know. It was the Council of National Council of Jewish Women had a group, a study group, mm-hmm. that surfaced the issue. They had a little pin that people wore. It was black with white equal sign on it. Mm-hmm. And at my other house, I had this sticker on my front window forever that said, open housing is morally right. Boy, those really grabby sayings. I don't know when that in the 60s that was. I'm just not good at the dates. But that campaign, I'm not even sure where the impetus started for that, whether it was the black community or the white community. I'm just not sure. But that heated up big, and it was a question of some interesting things happened as a consequence of it. We had these demonstrations all around town supporting open housing and being, you know, people being attacked by the opposition. And the demonstrations, I think, were to propose to pass an anti-discrimination ordinance by the Board of Aldermen. And it took a while. One of the interesting byproducts of that whole thing was that the Human Relations Commission's first director was a Quaker named Mansur Tidings. And he supported passage of an open housing ordinance and came out publicly so stating, and his commissioners fired him. When they fired him, the National Association of Human Rights Organizations, which is an affiliation of all these state and local agencies nationally, blackballed the Human Relations Commission and got the word out, nobody should apply for the vacant job now. And the place was absolutely leaderless for, I think, a couple years. In the interim, my rabbi, who married me, had gotten deeply involved in Negotiation Now, which was an anti-war group that wanted to negotiate a peace settlement, he and another minister. His congregation became very impatient with him and angry with him because he was spending a lot of time and energy doing anti-war stuff, and they thought he wasn't making enough hospital visits and tending, you know, da-da-da-da-da. So when he went to them for a raise, when his contract was up at 19, whatever year it was, 69 or 70, they said no, they weren't going to do it, and he resigned from my synagogue as rabbi. His wife, who was a real balabusta and a real intellectual, talked him into going and applying for the job that Mansur had been fired from. And, you know, he was out of work for a while, and then he went and applied, and they hired him, and they were delighted to have somebody fill that position.
And this was all before Galen Martin?
No, this was his local agency. Galen was a state.
Oh, I gotcha. Okay. Right.
He hired me in 1975. When I'm, you know, trying to figure out what kind of marketable skills have I got. I mean, I didn't have many, really, or at least I didn't know how to sell them. So he had gotten some money from the Democratic mayor to do some women's programming. We had been pushing Harvey Sloan, the mayor, to put some resources into programming for women. So good old Harvey gives Martin Perley, the director, $8,000 to hire staff to do it. So Martin hired me. And I started work, this was chilling, I started work at the Human Relations Commission in August of 1975, on the day that school started, the year we desegregated, and my office building was directly across the street from the city police department. And when I turned around the corner to go into this building and look across the street at the city police department, and their parking lot is wall-to-wall police in black riot gear with the helmets and things down and black everywhere and rifles. And it was chilling. It was just scary as hell. I mean, to see these people all prepared for God knows what.
They thought that there was going to be a lot of violence.
Well, everybody did. Everybody mm-hmm. thought so. So that was the day I began work. And I was the only one in that whole agency who knew anything about the schools or school desegregation or integration or any of it. So there's this huge vacuum, which I then proceeded to fill, and the same was true of the women's stuff. Mm-hmm. And for a long time, I was really the presence of that agency. The directors were kind of just... Although Martin, I got to say, was very good about getting out publicly and taking the moral high road. Mm-hmm. Nobody else has done that since mm-hmm. in all the years that he's been gone. It's a real loss to the community that they don't have somebody, a vocal spokesperson.
Mm-hmm. When the schools desegregated, were your children concerned about potential violence?
I don't think so. I mean, we never talked about, we didn't do that mm-hmm. at home. Only one of my children, the year we desegregated, was being bused out mm-hmm. of the neighborhood to the school in the downtown area. And it was a really good experience for him. Mm-hmm. It was interesting, you know. He was in the middle school. I guess he was in the 7th grade by then, and he could handle that kind of stuff. Rachel, I guess, was... Rachel was 10 that year. Mm-hmm. Danny was 13. So, I mean, you know, they were not mm-hmm. little wee things. And I don't think the question of violence came up in terms of the East End. I mean, that's not where the mm-hmm. violence was being focused. It was out in the county, in the schools that were ringing the county. The East End was too well-behaved and too polite mm-hmm. to support that.
Well, were they busing black children into the mm-hmm. counties? Was that the basis for the concern?
The basis of the concern was that some county students were even bused into the inner city. Mm-hmm. And they didn't want their kids to leave the neighborhoods and go into that terrible inner city. And then I heard, amazingly enough, people would actually admit to these things, that they didn't think it was a good idea to bring black children into the white neighborhoods, because then the black, this is really sad, then the black kids would see what white kids have and they'd want it too. mm-hmm. Don't you wonder about people's willingness to say such terribly crass mm-hmm. things. Mm-hmm. So there was that kind of resistance, and there were, of course, the normal real apprehension about change, which wouldn't have made any difference much what it was, but then it was confused and exacerbated by adding race to the whole mm-hmm. thing when people were so, they weren't even ambivalent about race. I mean, in 1975, when that thing happened, blacks were clearly inferior, and that's all there was mm-hmm. to it, and they were criminal element, and they were violent, and they were going to rape their daughters. And
was Lyman Johnson active with
Lyman? Was on, yes, Lyman or? Got himself elected to the Board of Education after that, and he and a friend of mine named Carolyn Hutto, and she would be very good to talk to, although she was never active in the civil rights movement. She just had good instincts and got herself elected. Well, actually, she was appointed to the board by the previous Louisville superintendent, Carolyn Hutto, Mrs. Jim, on Hill Road. Lyman was elected. He was the president of the NAACP. I was on his board at the time he got elected. And he and Carolyn, for a long time, were the only voices there, you know, in terms of advocating mm-hmm. for black students. Lyman was very active, mm-hmm. very active. He was very important.
And what was the NAACP doing at this point? They were part of the lawsuit, but they didn't really do a lot. Were they doing educational forums?
Yeah, they had they had an education committee chair, because I was on his committee, and they weren't doing much. They haven't been really viable here in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. I mean, in my public lifetime.
Right.
Now you can't even find them. I mean, I've been trying to get them involved, and there is no them right now. They're just totally gone.
Was there ever...
There was an SCLC.
Okay, let me finish the NAACP. Was there ever any educational literature that was designed, distributed, door-to-door canvases?
Not that I'm aware of. There may have been. I'm not aware of it.
Okay. Go ahead and talk about SCLC.
Well, the SCLC was probably at the time, because of Dr. King, more viable than the NAACP. But it's gone, it's sort of dissolved too. Mm-hmm. They had a preacher named Reverend, what was his name?
Not A.D. Williams. That was Martin's brother.
That was his
brother.
He drowned. It'll come to me. I don't know why there weren't any vital black groups. Mm-hmm. There just weren't. Mm-hmm. Now the black community is pretty well organized around economic issues and mm-hmm. economic development issues and those kinds of things. It's just not real, and still not pressing much on mm-hmm. the civil rights stuff. I guess mostly those battles have been won to some degree.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So in 1990, you became the executive director of the Metropolitan Housing Coalition. Mm-hmm. Is that, tell me about the history of the coalition, and are they there in part because of some of the earlier interest in housing issues?
Mm-mm.
No? Okay.
No, they're an outgrowth of the Reagan budget cuts and real concern by social service people and city and county housing officials in around 1989 that those budget cuts were going to produce horrendous effects on poor people in the community, and that we better start strategizing about how we're going to try and staunch that wound. And so about 10 or 15 of them started meeting, and they drafted some bylaws, and they got incorporated and limped along. Well, it did probably better than that. And in about a year, hit up the Bingham Fund for money to professionalize. And so they got that money right before I walked off the ACLU job. And a friend of mine who had been in on the ground floor of that came and talked to me, and she said, you know, that'd be a great job for you. And I didn't know a damn thing about housing, nothing. But I also didn't know what I was going to do for myself in the future, mm-hmm. and I was not independently wealthy. And
had you divorced by that?
Oh, yeah, and he had died.
Oh, okay.
He had died. This was...
Okay.
He died in 1986, and he died about 12 days after the divorce was final.
Mm, okay.
So I was had been living here alone for 4 years. And so I decided, okay, I'll apply for the job. And so I sent my resume off, and I got a call to come for an interview. But they wanted to hire somebody on a contract basis. So I proceeded to go in there, and they're nice people, and some of them I had known. And I proceeded to tell them why that won't work, and that, you know, it's a great that they got this funding, but I'm not the right person for the job, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and that I'm sure you'll find somebody who will do it on a contract. And I left. And the president called me up later in the afternoon. He said, what would it take to get you? I said, $25,000, health insurance, pay my taxes, and a commitment that some of the executive committee members would meet with me once a week. And I don't mean for 6 weeks, but ad infinitum, because I don't know a damn thing. And he said, okay, it's done. So I tease him all the time. It's probably one of the smartest things he's ever done in his life. And I think he did so too. And it's just been great. I've loved it. My executive committee met with me every single Wednesday morning for 2 years at breakfast for 7:30 downtown. And it was only ended after 2 years because I had a new president who didn't want to get up that early. And she just unilaterally called it off. I was so angry with her. I'm still angry about it because it was great. I mean, they got a lot of information that way. I mean, they just showed up, not mm-hmm. the same ones every single week, but, you know, mm-hmm. a critical mass, 3 or 4 people, sometimes 8 or 9. And it was just, it was great. I thought, well, the honeymoon period's got to end. Sometimes it never did. I mean, mm-hmm. Dolores interrupted it, and I had a couple of bad years with her. When I took the job as director of the MHC, the board had 21 members, 2 black people, very low profile on the equity stuff, and it took me about 6 years to reshape the board, but I did, and now 25% of my board is African-American, is geographically, age, economically, and occupationally diverse. I also created a fair housing coalition within my coalition, and I pulled together for monthly meetings those organizations and agencies that have a vested interest in ending discrimination in housing. And that's been the Urban League and the Kentucky Commission on Human Rights and the Human Relations Commission and NOW mm-hmm. and the Fairness Campaign, which is trying to get civil rights protections for gays and lesbians. It's about 15 different groups. Mm-hmm. And I sort of pumped up the fair housing anti-discrimination part of MHC's mission to be really out there, and we've become the primary advocate, not the either of the commissions, but MHC has become the primary advocate for ending racial segregation in housing and racial and economic in Jefferson County. So it's been a really good vehicle for that. I am convinced that I'm on the mayor's transition team where he likes me and I like him, but I pulled together two really effective candidates forums, one in April on fair housing, which is April's Fair Housing Month, and one in October on affordable housing issues. And we it was at the, they were both at the Urban League at 5:30 in the evening, and each of them had 100 people. And Intermedia, which is our cable company, televised the last one, and it's been on and on and on and on. And so I've been able to pump up their persona, you know, in the community, mm-hmm. and I've been able to pump up the civil rights piece of it. Mm-hmm. And it's good because, you know, I'm old enough now, I know I have to bring my board along, and so I've just been sort of mm-hmm. feeding them.
Do you have to raise money, too?
Oh, yeah. I have to do everything. I have to raise the budget. I have to dream up the meetings. I have to find new board mm-hmm. members. Or I can't think of a function I
Is
don't do.
Is the Bingham Fund still supported?
No, because it folded when she died. It was the mm-hmm. end of the mm-hmm. fund when Mary Bingham died 3 or 4 years ago. But mm-hmm. I did cultivate a relationship with the director of the foundation and got him to give me $25,000 more. I asked mm-hmm. for 50, and he was being chintzy. But he gave me $25,000 more, so it was mm-hmm. $125,000 really.
So where do you raise your money?
My money comes from membership fees for my members.
Which are organizations.
Let's see what I've got here, yeah.
Now don't walk too far away.
You should read this because this is sort of okay. our present platform.
That would be good.
Oh, let's see if I have it. Here it is.
You have how many organizations?
102.
That are members.
They pay
the
dues. The city and the county give me a very, very little bit. Here it is.
What are the leading civil rights groups in Louisville today?
Probably the Kentucky Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression, which is bringing Angela Davis here mm-hmm. this weekend.
Right.
And the ACLU. Mm-hmm. And that's probably it.
Okay. I'm going to stop and suggest we come back another time
okay.
and talk about Kentucky Civil Liberties Union and
okay.
some of the women's issues a little bit more. But I just wonder, based on what all we talked about today, is there anything you think you'd do differently?
That I would do differently?
Yeah.
Oh, my God, everything. I would do everything differently. Sure, I never understood people who say I wouldn't change a thing. I think, I would not have 5 children. I would not marry so young. I would prepare myself for some kind of a real job. I wouldn't waste so much time and energy. Well, no, that's not true. I mean, I guess those are all personal things. Occupationally, I don't think I would do anything differently. I mean, I'm proud of the work I did in each of the 3 jobs I've had. It's amazing to me, with as little training as I've had, formal training as I've had, that I've been as effective as I have been. And I love to work with people, and each of these jobs has allowed me to work with and I've been very fortunate in the people I've been able to work with. And I get a lot of my power and strength from having a base behind mm-hmm. me. So I don't have any real regrets professionally. I have a lot of, any woman who juggles all this stuff, mm-hmm. I mean, something's got to give, mm-hmm. and so I have some regrets about those issues.
Okay, let's stop.